Welcome to Spoiler Peace Theater, the podcast that doesn't give a shit about spoilers. We just want to talk about the movies. My name is Evan Crean. I am co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of your 80s movie guide to better living. My pronouns are he, him.
My name is Megan Kearns. My pronouns are she, her. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network. I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and I'm a member of Gallica, the Society of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics.
And my name is Dave Riedel. I write about movies for the Chicago Reader. I talk about movies, blah, blah, blah. And my pronouns are he, yeah, there is something else that I forgot what it was. My pronouns are he, him, and I'm a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association also.
Yes,
you are. Yes, I am.
Indeed.
Whoops. It's like a tape, like rewound real quick. I don't know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That was my best tape rewinding sound.
That was a good one.
Anyway, so we're here to talk about movies as usual, but before we get to this week's movies, of which there are three, we'll just give a quick plug to our Patreon. Over on our Patreon exclusive audio this week, we are talking about the 1998 Steven Spielberg film Saving Private Ryan, which is 25 years old this year. So continuing on our trend of talking about movies that have big anniversaries this year. And had a really great conversation about the film. So if you're not a patron, consider joining for $5 a month. You can get access to exclusive episodes like this one and other perks like voting in polls and whatnot. So head over to patreon.com/spoilerpiece. And also a quick shout out to our patron, Heather Sachs, who is our sponsor piece patron. So thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
And for this week, we have three movies, as I mentioned. We are going to be talking about Creed 3. We're going to be talking about The Year Between and La Civile. And Dave is going to kick us off with Creed 3. So, Dave, let's hear about this movie that's directed by Michael B. Jordan and written by Keenan Coogler, Zach Malin, Ryan Coogler. And I can even give the one-sentence IMDb if you like.
Please do.
Adonis. I like that it doesn't say Adonis Creed here. Adonis has been thriving in both his career and family life, but when a childhood friend and former boxing prodigy resurfaces, the face-off is more than just a fight. Oh my god, this is a bad summary.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a bad movie. I mean, it's not. It's so much less good than Creed and Creed 2 that it just kind of feels like it's kind of, I think this is what Stallone want. First of all, I should mention Stallone had no involvement in this because, he is angry at Irving Winkler. I don't know. The original Rocky producer still owns the rights to the Rocky franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like the direction the story was going in. And he's just like, I'm out. And they don't even mention Rocky. Like, not once. Whoa. Yeah. The only connection they have to him is that the gym is still called the Adelphi Gym, except it's moved. Adonis has moved it from Philadelphia to Los Angeles.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he runs it now, and he's like he's not a promoter, but he's like a manager. And then, you know, Avon Barksdale from The Wire is still like his main.
Yes.
Yeah, his nice. Main.
He's actually got kind of a bigger part in this one than he did good. The other two. Yeah.
He's a good actor.
I just always like seeing him. And I kind of feel like if Rocky V were a good movie, this would be it.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I've got a clear picture of what you're talking about here.
Because the story is that, first of all, and I wouldn't consider this a retcon because there's so little we know about Adonis's life before the first movie happens. I mean, we don't even really know much about his childhood except for that one scene when Felicia Rashad comes to get him from the group home. Mm-hmm. And this movie opens up with a flashback to when he's, I don't know, he's 14, 15, something like that. And he's going to help his friend, you know, basically be his corner man for the character that Jonathan Majors plays as an adult, Damian Anderson is the name. They call him Dame. Help his friend Dame, like, just be in his corner for a Gold Gloves match he has. And, you know, Dame is like this prodigy and wins his fight and it's a big deal. And, you know, Felicia Rashad doesn't like him. So Michael B. Jordan, well, the young Creed has to sneak out the window to do the thing. And as chance would have it, after winning the Gold Gloves match and, you know, being the best, you know, teen boxer in California, they're going to like buy some, I don't know, just some treats for themselves at like a convenience store. And Adonis is going in first and he happens to see like this, I guess he was like some sort of parental figure at one of the group homes where he and Dame lived. And he used to be physically abusive. And Adonis sees him and just starts beating the fuck out of him. And then a couple guys grab Adonis to pull him off. And then they're about to beat the crap out of him. And then Dame pulls a gun on everybody. And you find out later that Creed ran off when the cops arrived and Dame got arrested. And he's just been released from prison after 18 years for that crime.
Wow.
And so now he's come back and he says, you know, basically, you owe me a title shot to Adonis. And it just so happens that the guy who's going to be having a title shot is Drago's kid.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, bringing him back. Eh?
He's barely in it. But so there's this fighter that Creed is managing. And then there's, you know, Drago's kid. And they're going to be fighting for the heavyweight championship. And Drago's kid gets assaulted while they're at like a party. And his arm gets broken. And of course, it turns out, and I'm giving the very abbreviated version of this, but it should come as no surprise to you that Jonathan Majors was the architect of that attack so that he could take the title shot. And then, of course, he turns turncoat, just like Tommy the Machine Gun. And
yep.
And then Creed, and then Creed has to fight him in the ring because nobody will fight Dame because he's just too good. And he also fights a little dirty. He uses some prison tricks, which you see in like close-ups in the fights, like grazing an opponent with his elbow in the face, you know, which you're not allowed to do. Mm-mm. And hitting like not below the belt, but just like right there, but kind of in the kidney, which you're not supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So
that is dirty fighting.
Yeah. And what I do like about this is this movie does explore PTSD, like lots of, you know, it examines the PTSD that Creed has for having come up in the group home and all those sorts of things. And there's the dynamic between, I keep going back and forth between wanting to call him Creed and wanting to call him Adonis. So let's just call him Adonis and we'll call Tessa Thompson Bianca because that's her name. Mm-hmm. And their relationship and how his inability to let go or examine or be introspective about that kind of stuff, which is a choice. Like he makes it clear that like, this is a choice. Cause you like, these are all the other things that I've dealt with. Like I'm supposed to, like our daughter's hearing loss and your hearing loss and me having to retire cause I'm too old. And you know, these are things that I can, he's like, I'm not dealing with that cause I don't want to. But then he has to, and then there's a big title fight, which he wins. Of course, some of the choices in the way the title fight is shot, I would take some issues with. Although this is now what, the 8th or 9th Rocky movie or movie in this franchise. So this is the 9th because Rocky Balboa is the 6th.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of like how in Rocky Balboa, for some reason during the fights, Stallone directed some of them to be black and white, but like everybody had colored sweat, like it was a Gatorade ad or something. And in this, after the first round, it like zooms into the ring and the fight is at wherever it is that the Lakers play, the Staples Center. And the Staples Center is empty and it's just the two of them in the ring. And that's actually pretty cool. But then he puts like, he shoots it like there's a cage on the outside of the, like a prison cell kind of cage on the outside of the ring and it's padlocked. And it's like, all right, I think you've taken your metaphor as far as you need to take it.
It's a metaphor.
Yeah. And so, so there's some stuff like that, that I think is just kind of corny, but overall it doesn't have the weight of the other two. Now that being said, it's significantly shorter than the other two. It clocks in at about, you know, pre-credits at about 150. So, so that's good. And it does move. It doesn't feel like you're not watching it and feeling like, ugh, this is a bad movie. You're just watching it and going like, this just isn't as good as the other ones. Mm-hmm. which I think is how a lot of people feel about like Rocky II. You know, there's like, it's fine. It's not Rocky, but it's fine. My favorite Rocky movie, of course, is Rocky III, which some people would think is crazy.
Oh my God. That is crazy.
Is it Clubber Lang? Is that it's it?
Totally. Yeah, because I saw it when I was like 8 years old or 9 years old. And Mr. T was fucking awesome. So
excellent smack talk in that movie.
Yeah.
Excellent smack talk.
There really is. I'm really looking forward to seeing like the recut of Rocky IV that Stallone did a year or two ago. Cause I know some people who've seen it and they're like, it's amazing. It's the same length, but it's actually a different movie now. It's totally bizarre in a good way. So this Creed III is fine. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a decent, you know, Michael B. Jordan knows how to pace a scene appropriately and et cetera, et cetera. And Jonathan Majors, of course, I don't really need to tell you that he is fucking amazing. I mean, I don't think there's anything this guy can't do.
Nope.
He's so good. He's so good. Especially when you consider the other movies, like, it's like a million miles away from, you know, Last Black Man in San Francisco. And what's the name of the Western that he was in?
The Harder They Fall.
The Harder They Fall. It's a million miles away from that. It's just, he's a knockout. So so that's Creed III. I mean,
okay.
I would wait for it for streaming, but you know, if you want to see it on the big screen, the boxing scenes were shot in IMAX, so maybe it's worth it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like your mileage may vary maybe, but ultimately you're erring on the side of see it.
Yeah. Megan, did you have a question? You looked like you did.
Not a question. I had a comment because I think it's really fascinating that Jonathan Majors filmed this and also was working on Magazine Dreams, where he had to have a bodybuilder body for that film because he's playing a bodybuilder or an aspiring one, as well as for this. And I just think it's fascinating because you're talking, Dave, about how it's so vastly different from Last Black Man in San Francisco, which was the first thing I saw him in too, and he's wonderful in that. But he really is amazing in anything and everything. He's excellent in Magazine Dreams, which I saw at Sundance. And yeah, so yeah. I'm very intrigued to see him in this too, just because he is such a versatile actor.
Yeah, I think the thing that's kind of like, about it is there really aren't any surprises in the whole like, oh, he's got a chip on his shoulder and now he's going to be a turncoat. It's like, well, of course he is. So like, where the fuck would the drama be otherwise? You know? Like, is he like, oh, you can have your shot now. I'm sorry about like running away from you. Here's your title shot. Everything's good. No, it's not going to do that. So, there's not a lot of boxing in this one though, which is interesting. Huh. I feel like in Creed and Creed II, there's actually a lot of boxing scenes. And this one is more about the drama of it, which in a way is similar to the first Rocky. There's like next to no boxing in the first Rocky.
That's true.
Which I love it when people who've never seen Rocky finally see it and they're like, there's no fucking boxing. It's like, no shit. Yeah. It's about a guy who hasn't even had his shot yet. Of course, there's no fighting in it. So there you go. That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, I'm definitely interested to see it, but I feel like I probably won't rush to. I'll watch it whenever it comes out in streaming.
Yeah.
All right. So then let's move on to The Year Between, which is a drama that is directed, written, and starring Alex Heller. And we'll give you the one-sentence IMDb summary here. Well, two sentences. Clemens Miller is coming home to live in her family's basement after dropping out of college with a newly diagnosed mental illness. Having to face her battered relationships and responsibilities of adulthood, she is driving everyone around her, crazy.
That ellipses is really unnecessary.
Wow.
Yep.
Hey.
So, as I mentioned, written, directed, and starring Alex Heller, she plays Clemens. And we've got Steve Buscemi plays her dad, and J. Smith Cameron plays the mom, and there's a few other people that I feel like I've seen in other things. But what did we think of this movie?
Well, I'll say one thing, and then I'll let you two both talk about it. There's that moment when she's with her therapist, when Clemens is with her therapist, and she's saying, I'm trying to figure out whether all of this that I'm going through, like all of this terrible behavior I'm going through right now, is my mental illness or just my personality. I'm paraphrasing. And that's kind of what I take away from this whole exercise. So I have other thoughts on it, but I'd rather hear you two.
Sure. Yeah. Megan, what did you think of this movie?
So I want to start off by saying that I always want to go in liking a film. It's always my hope. That's always my goal, especially when it's a first-time filmmaker, especially when it's a woman filmmaker, especially when it's a semi-autobiographical film.
Mm-hmm.
And I applaud that Alex Heller partnered with NAMI Chicago, which is a mental health organization that advocates for mental health and to destigmatize mental illness. And I think that there are a lot of films and TV series that perpetuate a lot of ableist tropes. And so I think it's always important to have really frank depictions and conversations about mental health and mental illness. And so I really applaud Alex Heller for working on this story. She tried to get this made for like 6 years and really pulled from her own experiences, as well as the experience of her best friend who was also going through mental health struggles and also had a parent who was dealing with cancer, very similarly, mm-hmm. that happens in this film.
Yep.
But unfortunately, I was not a fan of this after having that very large preface.
The preamble.
Yes, I love a preamble. I love a preface. But yeah, what I couldn't help wondering while I'm watching this is Alex Heller the best actor for this role? And, you know, I can totally understand why she did it because it is such a personal project. But I kept having the problem while I was watching this that I felt like we're being told things. We're being told that she's crazy. And I'm using crazy because I tend not to use that word because it is a very ableist term, even though it's become obviously a part of our lexicon as something much more benign, but it is still very ableist at its core. So, but she calls herself crazy. She keeps talking mm-hmm. about how she had a meltdown. And, you know, I am someone who struggles myself with a lot of mental health issues, not bipolar disorder, but with depression and anxiety and PTSD. I have a lot of people in my life who have bipolar disorder. So I'm familiar with it from that stance, not personally, but being around people who have that, those challenges. And I know that this is just her personal story. And she has said that. She said this in interviews, like, this is just one person's story. It's my experiences. So it's not going to be universal, of course. But I'm watching this and I'm watching everything that's happening. And I'm like, I feel like we're being told things. We're being told she had a breakdown. We're being told that she's struggling with her medications and the cocktail of medications, which is very accurate and very true. It's hard to find the right dosage and percentage mm-hmm. and all of that. And I'm glad we're seeing it on screen. And I'm glad we're seeing that she's going to a psychiatrist. And I'm glad we're seeing her therapist. And I'm glad we're seeing her family, who I think are acting like a bunch of assholes. Even though she's an asshole, I think they're assholes to her in turn. And they're very insensitive about all the things she's struggling with. And I don't think people understand if you haven't dealt with, you know, a lot of intense therapy or you haven't dealt with medication. Those side effects are a motherfucker. Those side effects knock you out. Mm-hmm. And people just don't get it if they haven't gone through it. So yeah, so I'm glad that's all there. But I felt like I didn't feel anything. I felt like very numb through a lot of this. That I'm just like, oh, yeah, okay. We're being told she's having a breakdown. But is that a breakdown? Like, and something else too that I kept watching, like I kept thinking about when I was watching this, she does the trope of cutting her hair, which is such a trope. And it drives me up a wall because that's how we show that women are buckling down in something or women are dealing with madness, is to show them chop all their hair off. Oh, mm-hmm. oh my God, aren't they so wild? They cut all their hair. And she does that. And maybe she did do that in real life. But I'm watching that. And again, I'm feeling like that's a very superficial trope way of indicating that she's struggling. What I will say that I think is a testament to this film is that she talked about in an interview about how she wanted to show not necessarily the highest of highs with mania or the lowest of lows with depression, but kind of the in-between, like how mm-hmm. you deal with the in-between and the kind of minutiae of day-to-day. And I think she does that somewhat well. So I have a lot of conflicting feelings about this film. I'm kind of rambling. I'm kind of all over the place because I have a lot of conflicting feelings about this film.
Fair enough. Dave, did you have anything? You said you had some other stuff you wanted to say.
Well, I mean, I think that this is definitely your mileage may vary kind of thing. I was struck, like Megan, by the fact that her family, except Steve Buscemi, I think,
yes,
are all assholes. And they do come around in their own ways.
Mm-hmm.
Although her little brother does seem to be just like a serious douchebag. But
totally.
I've seen that kid in something. Was he in It?
Yeah.
He was.
Yeah, right.
He played Stan.
Of course. Of course he was Stan. I did like how she sort of awkwardly befriended her coworker who just hated her at the beginning. I thought like, this is a really strange friendship that has, for some reason, is working. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. That it was forced, but it somehow ended up, but they faked it until they made it, basically.
Yeah. I thought her mother was kind of insufferable just because, you know, as a parent now, when your kids do things that make you want to pull your own hair out or shave it, there's really, you try to look at it from their perspective, but a lot of times you can't because I don't remember what it's like to be 8. So I vaguely remember it. So I sort of have some sympathy with her mother not suffering, it seems, from mental illness herself, not knowing how to deal with Clements, because you get the feeling that this is, maybe it's not as extreme, or maybe this time it's more extreme than it's ever been, but she's mm-hmm. been, there have been hints of this undiagnosed for many, many years.
Right.
And so from that angle, it's just the family members being so like, that's kind of hard. Like I said, though, they mostly come around. The other thing is the year between not dealing necessarily with the highest mania or the lowest depression, I think is a good idea, but it does come across in the execution as a little one note.
Yes. Thank you.
And like the only time you really see her character start the change is like at the end, in like the last 15 minutes when, you know, she starts thinking about whether she's going to go back to college and, you know, when she very awkwardly and inappropriately stalks her ex-roommate into the bathroom.
Oh.
Yeah, that was certainly an awkward moment, of which there are many in this film. Yes. Very, very uncomfortable moments.
But I think that is an example of how, even though it's like a horrific moment in the non-horror movie sense, it's evidence that Clem has a long way to go. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I do like that there's, at the end of the movie, there's not like, she's cured. It's like, nope, mm-hmm. this is something you're going to have to, which the German doctor,
the
which
German
I think that's
woman.
Funny, the German woman, that she calls the psychiatrist calls the German woman.
To take away her power.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that yes, the doctor does say that, but then In that instance, Megan, that's one where she tells and then shows,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that there's a lot of like explaining what's going on rather than showing what's going mm-hmm. on. So, you know, it's a mixed bag for me. I wasn't bored by it and a lot of it did not make me angry. But at the same time, it's just like, if this is not something you're necessarily interested in learning about or watching as a piece of entertainment, I'm really not sure if this is your movie, you know? So,
Fair enough. Those
of you who are wondering whether maybe you suffer from a mental illness but don't know it, maybe watch this. I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps. Might help somebody.
Yeah.
I like this movie more than both of you. I actually did like Alex Heller in the main role, but I agree with Dave in that, is this just your personality? Because I found her to be quite funny in the you're a dick, but you're a funny dick kind of way. Like, I found her likable despite the fact that she was a dick. So for me, her personality was still charming despite its dickishness. But there's definitely a question of like, are you just... If it works for you, which it did for me, is it because she's just that good at just basically just kind of playing herself in this? Or is it because she's like really delving into a character that is based on her and based on her friend. I don't know. But I did like this. I found it funny. I found that it had, for me, an emotional honesty to it, even in points where maybe the dialogue wasn't as strong, but I felt like the underlying sentiments of what the characters were feeling felt real, even when they were being assholes, because families in real life are complicated and they get at each other. And I think there's a good amount of this movie that the people spend fighting and saying shitty things to each other. But I do, to your point, Dave, like that they kind of all kind of come around in their own way, in their own pace, that by the point when the mom needs to go in for her surgery, when she, you know, her cancer surgery, it's like they're all there. And then that seems to be kind of like a turning point where they're all kind of figuring their shit out. And figuring out how to kind of adapt to this new way of, or this new understanding of each other. So I dug this. I found it funny. I found it charming, in probably the typical quirky indie dramedy kind of way. It felt kind of cliche in that way of like, I could see going to like an independent film festival, watching this movie and going, yeah, okay. Yeah. This belonged in the lineup and I found it fun.
Well, it did premiere at Tribeca. So
yeah,
there you go.
And, I feel like it had a kind of, you know, the kind of ending that I enjoy in this kind of movie. Like Dave, you were saying, it's like, you know, we see her and we know that she's come a long way, but we also know that she's got a long way to go. And that's kind of where we need to leave the character.
Yeah.
It worked for me.
In case there was no mystery, or there was any mystery about whether she had a long way to go, that final scene kind of, I think, puts the mystery to rest.
Oh yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, though, is that recovery of any form is not a straight line. It's always, like, you know, like steps, ebbs and flows, backs and forths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I do think it's interesting, though, Evan, that you talk about likability. And Dave, you kind of hinted at it and kind of, not even hinted at it, you did address it. I don't have a problem with the fact that she's a dick. I don't have a problem with that at all. I just don't think she's funny. And I don't think this film is funny at all. So yeah, but yeah, I kind of like that she's abrasive, you know. Mm-hmm. I like abrasive, assertive, opinionated characters who are messy and complicated. So I think that's where my frustration lies, is that on paper, this sounds like something I should adore, like that I should just absolutely love this. And I applaud it. I think there are some things it gets really right. And yeah. But I love that you had a much better film watching experience, yeah. Evan.
Yeah, me too.
I wish I'd had the same.
Yeah, I wish you did too, because I found this a very enjoyable hour and 34 minutes. Yeah.
I think I was somewhere between you two. So,
I mean, like you, Dave, I wasn't bored by any means. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's an unusual, I mean, a lot of it is kind of right down the central dramedy line, like you said, Evan. But it's also just kind of when you have a character, and I don't mind abrasive characters either. I mean, take Dirty Harry, for instance. But but yeah, there is something about the sort of having no soft edges of the character. I guess that's the best way I can put it. That it seems like maybe a little more nuance would have benefited there.
Yes.
But
yes,
you know, who can, maybe that's like what this character is actually like. And it's an, you know, honest, realistic portrayal. Who knows?
Yeah. What I will say, speaking of honest and realistic portrayals, I do appreciate that in the sex scene or the attempted sex scene that she's like all in. And the guy's like, oh, are you wet? And she's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he's like, you're bone dry.
Yeah.
And, you know, because that's what meds do sometimes. You know, there's unfortunately some really shitty side effects. So anyway, I did like that. And I liked those kinds of moments. I agree with you, Dave, though, that I don't know if she needed to be softer by any means, but as far as what you're saying about nuance, like kind of shades of gray and things like that, like in that way, like, yeah, I definitely agree with you. Like to me, No, I was just gonna say, to me, this felt kind of like this would have worked as like a short film, but when you're stretching it out, I need more nuance.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think soft wasn't the right word. I chose the wrong word, but nuance.
That's the right word. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the right word. But I think you're saying, when I don't want to speak for you, but when you're saying like soft, I think you mean like in contrast of the hard edges. Like so.
Yeah,
contrast,
that's all
like,
I mean. Yeah. I mean, she's just so abrasive, which is fine. But there's, and I don't want to say the performance is one note because it's not, but it's also not like three note.
Yeah. I would have even been happy if we saw her like lose her shit and get like really angry. Like that would have been different. And that still wouldn't have been, you know, like any kind of moment of vulnerability or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like for me, there were moments of nuance when we're talking about how she interacts with her younger sister. Like when they go and play dress up, and it feels like it's coming from a place of like, we're going to do this together. This is going to be a fun thing that we're going to do. And we're just going to goof around. Or later when they're laying on the bed talking about life or school or whatever is next for both of them. I did feel like there were probably, to what you were saying, Dave, more like a two note performance.
Yeah.
Not quite three, which might have been anger or some other maybe more explosive elements to her character, but I liked it. I think there was enough softness, to use your word, Dave, whether you agree with the softness or not, as a descriptor, there was enough tenderness to the character to me in moments that I'm like, okay,
tenderness.
For her, there's not a lot of it. She's not tender very often, but she can be in moments and she can access that place, I think. With people.
I think you're right, Evan, but I think for me, I know what it is, and I should have said this earlier, but I think as we're talking about this, I'm working it out as we're talking.
As you do,
that's why I love talking with you guys about it, because it helps to get to the root of things. I think for me, as an I don't mean as an actor myself, but as her as an actor, I think her face is really one note. Like her face is not expressive. And there are some people who just do not have expressive faces. And I feel like if that is the case, you need to know your body, you need to know your face, and you need to know how to, I want to say like push through that or counteract that, but maybe do other things to convey those emotions that may not be so apparent for an actor who has a more expressive face. So I think that's the issue with me. Cause you're right. I'm listening to you talk, Evan, and I'm like, yep, no, that's a good scene. And you're right. There's some, you know, tenderness with her sister there and she's having fun and there's some variance there. But yeah, I think for me, it comes down to, I think another actor should have done this performance, but clearly you don't, and it worked for you, Evan. So you know, there we are.
Yep. Here we are. Sometimes we disagree about things, but that's fun.
Exactly.
All right. Well, is there? Did either of you guys have other things you want to talk about with this film?
Nah.
I'm glad this film exists because we need more conversations and depictions of characters.
That's true.
Dealing with mental illness and. There are so much stigma, and there are so many misconceptions about bipolar disorder. So I think that's great.
Yeah. Movies that are better than The Sun, for example.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yikes.
That movie.
Right. I feel like there's maybe some lingering PTSD.
I was just going to say, I didn't mean to like snap anybody back to, you know, those moments. So.
Oof. Okay. So then maybe let's move on. So the last movie we're going to talk about is called La Civil, which is Spanish for The Civilian. And it is directed by Teodora Mihai, and it's also written by her. And it is co-written by Habacuc Antonio de Rosario, and it's starring Arcelia Ramirez, Alvaro Guerrero, Jorge A. Jimenez, and Let's see who plays. Why does IMDb never tell me the stuff that I want?
That's why I don't use them. I use the press notes.
Where's who plays the daughter in the film?
Well, I mean, how many scenes is she in, really?
Like two.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to the summary. So this is the story of Cielo, who is a mother whose teenage daughter is kidnapped in northern Mexico. And when the authorities offer no support in the search, Cielo takes matters into her own hands and transforms from a housewife into a vengeful militant. I think the plot summary maybe implies... the plot summary implies that this is more of like an action-y movie, and this is more of like an emotional drama about someone's like ethics, and more about like the lengths that they're willing to go to try and find their, you know, to try and find her daughter when the law is not working for her, and her really only other option is to like work with these soldiers who are going around trying to like hunt down the drug cartels and, you know, beat people for information and kill people
with no evidence.
Yes.
I mean, when they was about an hour into the movie when they kill those two women who are supposedly, one of them's a high ranking whatever in the cartel, and then the other one works in it too. It's just like, you just kidnap them off the street. It's not really all that different from what the cartel did to Cielo's daughter. Nope. Think about it. But I think that is maybe part of the point. So
yeah.
See.
Yep. So this is a film about a parent doing anything and everything to try and find their child when the official channels are not working at any turn. And what did you two think? What did you think, Megan?
I thought this was great. I really liked this tremendously. I love a slow burn. I think there, it's interesting because, you know, I know what you're saying, Evan, that you're saying it's not an action movie, and that definitely makes it seem that way. And that's what the press notes do too. And the director interview, she talks about it almost like it is an action movie, even though she's very aware that there's a ton of slowness and downtime in this. Mm-hmm. But I think the moments where the tension does kind of ratchet up does feel like an action movie in those brief moments. But I really liked that. I think they were well shot. I think the lead performance by Arcela Ramirez is really fantastic. I think she really anchors the film. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I really liked that this was such a slow burn. I really liked how it unfolds, and it feels long. Like, this film is over 2 hours. And it feels long intentionally, I would imagine, because you're feeling the weight of her waiting around to hear about her daughter, Laura. And, you know, there's like these leads, and then she rushes off, and then she talks to the soldiers, and then they go and they do these clandestine missions, and then they beat people up, and they're doing these horrific things. And then she waits, and then she gets another tip, and then she rushes after them. And like, she sits in her car spying on people. Like, so it's a lot of like, like a lot of like inhalation and then exhalation. Like, it's a lot of like just waiting around, and much like she's waiting around, and like I'm sure many parents who are dealing with missing children are waiting around, and it's horrendous. But I really found this fascinating, and I really like the visuals. There's one scene in particular where after she talks to the head soldier who she works closely with, you see her shadow against the wall. It's this like graffitied wall. And I love great that scene. It is. It's such a great visual, but also of course, like, it's showing how she's becoming shadowy herself, like in the sense of her morality is becoming more in the gray. And then later on, the guy, Kinke, she's known for years and years and years in the community. And then she beats the shit out of him and kills him because she thinks that he's the reason that he sold out Laura to the narcos. Mm-hmm. And it's so wild to see how far she will go and what she will do. And like, then, you know, towards the end of the film, she's following a woman that she brought flowers to so she can, you know, go to the guy who she thinks kidnapped Laura, and then she's running around with a gun, just like very nonchalant and cavalierly. And it's like, what are you doing? But it just shows like how far she's willing to go to not only get Laura back, but just to find out the truth. And it's just gutting. So yeah. And I also, I'm sure we'll get into it more because I want to hear what you guys have to say, but I love that non-ambiguous ending.
Oh, what did you think? I think her number's up. That's what I think.
Oh, her number's up. Absolutely. Also, I thought that her number was up, but then after reading the behind the scenes and the press notes about how this is based on a true story, you know, Miriam Rodriguez, who was murdered outside her house in 2017, I'm like, oh, well, that's definitely what happened to her then. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I don't think I took that away, that she was standing up and she was going to be killed by someone. That's, mm-hmm.
That's what I thought. Because at first I'm like, who is she looking horrified at? Is it Laura? Is it her ex-husband back? Is it the guy who she's been kind of chasing the whole film who, you know, bribed her in the beginning because he threatened her? Is it someone else, like some kind of, you know, henchman, assassin? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, the way the look on her face, I'm like, I think she's killed. And then, like I said, after reading that, I was like, yeah, that for me solidified it.
That's interesting.
What do you think happened?
My interpretation was that she maybe saw her daughter, but I was also found the ending quite frustrating because I was like, if we spent this whole movie searching for her daughter and she thought her daughter was dead and her daughter shows up, why cut away? Because I feel like tonally it didn't match the rest of the movie. It had a kind of like ambiguous, slightly more like whimsical is not the right word, but just bear with me on it. It had in tone a different ending than the rest of the movie, which for me felt very kind of grounded and serious. And I was like, what the fuck is with this ending? Because I was like really enjoying the movie and I was like, what the fuck with this ending? I was so mad. I was like, I feel like this completely in my mind did not match the tone of the rest of the movie. But I guess if she's being killed, then okay. I feel more okay with the ending than if it was just like, you know, her daughter shows up and then we don't even get to see that moment. We've talked about this in some other movies that I find very frustrating. Like we talked about it with the climbing movie, The Fall, and just like not getting the satisfaction of the like, oh, they actually got, we didn't see them get the rescue after we've spent all of the emotional labor. That's kind of what I was feeling at the ending of this. I was like,
yeah, I love ambiguity, so I'm okay with it. But I can, I can understand you feeling robbed.
Sorry, Dave. I feel like you had something to say about the ending, but I got so fired up about it.
No, when I said her number's up, I thought that there was somebody coming to like shoot her in the face. You know? So I did think that the cut was like really jarring, I guess on purpose, but like, when it cut to black right there, I was like, oh, what the fuck? I you know, I hit the go back 10 seconds button twice on my remote just to make sure that it hadn't accidentally skipped ahead.
I did it too.
You know? So, I think that I think this movie's fine. I don't really think I was surprised by anything, partly because I actually, when I was watching it, I'm like, I feel like I know this story. And then I just Googled La Seville, you know, movie reviews. And then the first one I read, I don't remember, I think it was in the Washington Post. It was like, based on the story of Miriam Rodriguez. I was like, aha, that's it. And that's because it's basically exactly the story. What I think is even more fascinating about this, though, is that the director started making a documentary about these kinds of people, and then one of the cartels scared them so badly, they're like, let's make a dramatic movie instead.
Yes.
So,
And she was working really closely with Miriam Rodriguez, too, where she was, like, telling the director, Teodora Ana Mihai, her whole life story and, like, the whole situation. And, yeah, it's a wild behind the scenes.
Yeah. And I also agree with you, Megan, that Arcelia Rodriguez is, she's terrific.
Oh, so good.
But otherwise, I just, slow burn. It's kind of like, if we're calling it a slow burn, I'm going to say it's like, you know, it's a very long wick and it almost got to the powder keg, but not quite, you know? Because like I said, I don't really think there was anything from you know, from her being, from Celia being kind of almost frozen with fear or indecision at the beginning, to her eventual almost becoming a fucking, you know, or becoming a gun wielding like kook. I just, none of it, it all just kind of fit the pattern to me. Which is, it's not bad. I mean, I was never bored, just kind of like with, what was the movie?
The
Year Between. But at the same time, I wasn't really surprised by anything right up to like, oh, we found like a rib of your daughter's in a mass grave. It's like, well, yeah, makes sense. That happens. You hear that story over and over. So I don't know. It's, more than anything, I found it kind of sad just because,
oh, yeah,
you know, that this is, this is this, a familiar story to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And also, I think I wanted to just like kind of remove myself from it a little bit, as, you know, I'm going to say it again, as, you know, because I have children. So, you know, et cetera. That's all I have to say right now. That's all I have to say about that.
Yep. That's where my mind went to.
Yeah.
So aside from the ending, I really dug this movie. It, for me, emotionally felt very similar to Identifying Features.
Yes. That's what next thing I was going to say.
Which is another film that I really love, about a mother's journey to try and find her son and having, you know, being stonewalled in all different directions by the cartels and by the authorities in Mexico. And so I really dug it, just because it felt like it was a similarly compelling story here. And I think it was extremely well acted by Arcella Ramirez. I think she was just fantastic in this. And I liked the supporting characters as well. I liked the guy who was the lieutenant, the army lieutenant. He was a real brutal kind of guy. It was like, it's funny, it's like, of all people, he was like sympathetic to her, but also he's like, well, she's got valuable intelligence for me, so maybe we can just like make a trade here. We'll use her intelligence and, you know, she can figure shit out, and then I'll get the people that I need to get. But the moment after you find out that he's been reassigned and you see her trying to interact with the soldiers, oof, that is brutal. She's trying to go to them for help and they're like, get the fuck out of here, lady. I don't give a shit about you. Like, I would run you over this truck. You're so of little value to me. And that to me was a real gut punch in the film.
Yeah.
Seeing them like go from like allies to like, you're useless and I could give two shits about you.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. Kind of. Thank you for reminding me of that.
But I was also just haunted by some of the imagery in this film. I mean, it reminds me of things that it reminds me of Identifying Features. It reminds me of things. I think there's this documentary I saw in 2013 called Narcocultura that was like about specifically accessing like violence in Mexico from the cartels through like a musical standpoint and like a specific genre of music that was popular with the cartels. But like, there's a lot of really scary violence in Mexico against people, and people who go missing and are never seen or heard from again. People are killed and left in mass graves. And in this movie, and Identifying Features, just really haunting things to think about. You know, someone goes missing, you never see him again. They, you know, find a rib of the daughter and they don't know any other body parts. Or there's that scene, the scenes where she's going to the undertaker basically and trying to look at bodies that have come in to see if they're her daughter. And she walks in that one room that's like overflow and there's, you know, heads in a cooler and decapitated bodies on a sleigh. It's just a row of skulls in one room. It's truly horrifying things. And the movie haunted me in that way for some of the grotesque imagery, and just knowing that despite the fact that this is not, it's a drama, it's a narrative, this kind of stuff is, it's not far from the truth. And so it chilled me to the bone.
Yeah. The scenes with the undertaker, when those two bodies, she learns on the news that the two bodies have been dumped in the road. And so she goes to the morgue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that guy's head in the cooler. I was just like, yikes. So
just for anybody to walk by and see a head hanging out of the cooler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the guy, when she and her ex-husband contact the police about the mass graves that they found, and she's like asking him how long it's going to take for all of the information to be put into the database. And he's like, I don't know, 3-4 months, who knows? And it's like, so like, Jesus. But yeah, I'm so glad. I was irritated at myself because I wanted to talk about identifying features, but I'm so glad that you mentioned it, Evan, because that was my number one film of that year. And I love it. Fernanda Valadez's film is just gorgeous. And I think these two films are really fascinating, and they'd be a fascinating double feature. Mm-hmm. Gutting double feature because this film has a lot of horrific imagery, like you said, but Identifying Features is really like gorgeous. Like it's visually poetic and stunning. Lyrical, even though these haunting things are happening, these just tragic horrors. And so they're dealing with the same thing. They're dealing with mothers searching for their children and kind of their relentless quests. But they're very different women and under very different circumstances, and they take very different paths. But I think it is highlighting such a tragedy that's occurring, and they're really powerful stories in that way.
For sure. Yeah. And then I think in ways that Identifying Features doesn't go for the gore, there's a lot of haunting emotional stuff. Like I do remember a part where she's going and trying to talk to people who are identifying remains, and it's a similarly gruesome thing where they're looking at, you know, charred remains and things and trying to make sense of them, and you're like, how can anyone make sense of like a bone or a couple of bones, you know? Oof.
Yeah, speaking of the morgue scene, I think the morgue scene is really fascinating too, because the mortician is talking about how they're so backed up and how they don't have enough resources and enough time, and they're just, bodies are just being dumped. And it's just like, she's saying this all kind of like she's clearly bothered by this. She clearly takes this seriously, but she's saying it in kind of a very casual way to this woman whose daughter is missing. And it's just like, Jesus, like what is happening? Anyway, just awful. All of it.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Actually, also, it's kind of funny. I was thinking a commonality between this and the year between, and women, you were talking about women cutting their hair under times of duress.
Yep. Oh, that. Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that pissed me off too.
Well, I think the thing that makes it even more infuriating is that she comes out of the bathroom or whatever, she comes out and her ex-husband, who's decided that he's going to stay with her to, quote, support her, goes, oh, wow, your hair looks really nice now. Like, you look great.
Like, as someone who has cut my own hair before, it was a fucking disaster. I do not recommend it.
I was impressed by how well she did with cutting her hair. I thought it actually did look good, but I was like, wrong time to give a compliment there, buddy.
Yeah.
Read the room, maybe.
I thought you were talking about the unrealisticness of her having such a nice haircut when she's just like, hack, hack, hack.
Yeah. I was impressed.
I'm just tired. And it is so funny that it happened in both the movies we watched this week. I'm just so tired of that. Like, come up with a different visual. I'm sorry, but there are more ways to show that a woman is distraught, or a woman is outraged, or a woman is doing something new with her life than chopping her hair off willy-nilly. Right. There's do something different.
Right. I mean, she could get bangs, right? Isn't that...
I think that counts as cutting your hair off, though, right? I mean,
yeah. But actually, funny enough, that is more realistic. Ay. But yes, aside from the hair cutting fiasco, yes, I thought this was great.
Yeah, me too. And just seeing the depths that she sinks to when she is beating her family friend with the baton or the I don't even know what it is. And then she rips off her mask, and you're like, you know, you're signing this guy's death warrant, right? Because he knows who you are, and the rest of these soldiers are not going to let that go. And that moment where they take him out to the desert, and then the lieutenant shoots him and then just looks at her and basically says, this is your fault. You shouldn't take off your mask. It's like, woof, that's brutal too.
It is. And, you know, Dave, you mentioned at the start of this conversation about how, you know, the soldiers are doing essentially what the cartel's doing, and they're, you know, kidnapping people with basically on like a tip, on a whim, with no evidence, no anything. And I think it's interesting because this film really leans heavily into torture to extract information. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think of Zero Dark Thirty and all of the controversy around that film and torture.
Yes.
And I think a lot of it is warranted. But I will also say, I think the really fascinating and kind of complicated thing about Zero Dark Thirty is that Zero Dark Thirty shows that you don't get accurate information from torture.
Correct.
And this film doesn't do that. And so I think that that's really interesting. Although I also don't think that this film is, again, kind of matching its ambiguous, not so ambiguous ending. I think it's trying, you know, it's not necessarily showing that like all the pieces are going to fit together and come together, but it is really interesting how it is leaning so heavily into torture as a way to extract information.
Yeah, it does. Although I feel like because it focuses a lot on the brutality of the torture, it's kind of like not necessarily saying it's a good way to get information, but like, look how the cartels and dehumanize people and treat them, you know, like disposable bodies. And look at these people doing the exact same thing once they're in a position of power, of treating the people that they kidnap and beat as just other, and people with zero humanity that they can just hit and abuse and shoot and kill and just dump on the street like they're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note,
I know, that's such a lovely, pleasant note.
I know.
Good I know.
Lord.
Yeah, I know. That's it's a downer movie, maybe. Should have ended on the year between. But, you know, we made decisions here. So
we made decisions, and now we have to live with the consequences of those decisions.
Yep, we do.
Very much like Cielo.
Yeah.
Very true. Okay. Well, did we have any other parting thoughts about La Civile before we do a recap?
I don't.
Nope.
Okay. So then let's bring it back around. So Creed 3, which is out in theaters now. Dave, what say you?
I mean, sure. Why not? Your mileage may vary.
Go see it.
I think it's, you know, wait for it, you know. Wait for it on streaming. It'll be out in what, 27 days, 42 days, whatever it is.
Not very long.
Yeah, not long.
All right. And all right, so The Year Between, which I believe will be in theaters, maybe on demand.
Both, I think.
Both. Okay. Where do we land on that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm very tepid on it, so.
Tepid. Okay. I would say thumbs up. I would recommend seeing it. So we got to get a thumbs up and a couple people are like,
There's some good stuff. There's some other. Yeah. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where do we land with La Civile?
I definitely say yes.
Yeah. I'd actually lean toward yes, even though I was more lukewarm on it than you two.
And I would say, yes, see it. And I feel a little bit better about the ending now that we've talked about it. So, but still annoyed because I was so with it for like the rest of the movie. And then it felt like the rug was pulled out from underneath me.
Isn't it amazing though, how an otherwise good movie can be ruined in like the final 3 seconds?
Yes.
Yes.
There's that French movie that I can't remember the name of from like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, which is about, it's about these two women who are like, they're in their late teens and they become friends. And then like, just there's craziness and one of them kills the other one. And, the one who does the killing, like looks at the camera for the last like 4 seconds. And it's just like, why did you do that? Why have you done that?
Dave, I love that you're spoiling a movie that we don't even know what it is. Like you haven't even said the title.
Right.
That's amazing.
Right. Yeah. And Dave, you're just sitting here being like, pourquoi?
Exactement.
All right. Well, those are the movies for this week. So I want to start off by saying a huge thank you to our editor, Otto Klammer. Otto, thank you for making us sound so great week after week. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Otto.
Thanks, Otto.
You can find the show anywhere you get podcasts, but you can also find us over at our website, spoilerpiece.com. That's also where you can head to find our merch. There's a merch tab on the website, so check that out. It'll take you to our TeePublic store, and you can get all kinds of cool Spoiler Piece stuff, notebooks, t-shirts, pillows. We got the works.
I'm working on a cat sweater, so... I'm just kidding.
Wait, I'm just picturing Dave knitting a cat sweater that somehow we're selling through a store that does print on demand.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Now that needs to happen.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, get on that.
So you can also find us on social media. We're Spoiler Piece Theater on Facebook. We're at Spoiler Piece on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email. We're spoilerpiece@gmail.com, or you can give us a call
at 862-21-PIECE.
You can leave us a voicemail, tell us, say hi, tell us your opinions about this week's movies, tell us we're right about them, tell us we're wrong about them. We just like hearing from people. And if you like the show, please rate and review us by going to ratethispodcast.com/spoilerpiece. And that will take you to your platform of choice, which could be Apple Podcasts or maybe Spotify. And you can rate and review us in those places. And it helps more people find the show. And it helps give us some cred out there in the podcast world. And maybe one day we'll get us onto Rotten Tomatoes as an official approved critic. We'll see. And if you really, really like the show, please consider joining our Patreon. As I mentioned at the top of this week's episode, we talked about the 1998 Steven Spielberg film Saving Private Ryan for his 25th anniversary this year, and we had a great conversation. So consider becoming a patron, and you can get exclusive audio and vote in polls and other good stuff by going to patreon.com/spoilerpiece. And my name is Evan Crean. I'm co-chair of the Boston Online Film Critics Association and co-author of your 80s movie guide to better living. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd as Real Recon, and that's real as in film reel.
My name is Megan Kearns. I write film reviews for Edge Media Network. I, too, am a member of the Boston Online Film Critics Association. I'm also a member of Gallica. You can follow me on Twitter at OpinionSWorld or on Instagram and Letterboxd at TheOpinionS.
And my name is Dave Riedel. I write for the Chicago Reader. I talk about movies. Am I a member of BAFCA? Yes, I am. I'm a member of BAFCA, and you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Dave Sees Movies.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.